Thank you very much, Vidanya. Brothers in the Dharma. So I got involved in the FWB around 1974. That was a couple of years before I was ordained. And in those days, there was none of this. There was no Padmaloka. There was no London Buddhist Centre. There were only a few centres in the FWB at that time. When I first went along, it was to Brighton, where there wasn't a centre. It was just classes being taken in somebody's front room. I lived near Brighton with my family at the time. And there were very few books around, very few Buddhist books around. And one of them I became aware of was the Sutra of Golden Light in a very scholarly translation, even quite biblical translation, which I actually rather like. And here it is. Here's one of the copies of the Sutra of Golden Light from that era. If you want to see it, no, it doesn't sort of look very much, but there it is. In those days, you know, we used to read everything that we could get our hands on. And like I said, there wasn't that much. And I read this sutra, and I found it a very, very strange book indeed. Had beautiful passages in it, particularly passages describing the Buddha. I particularly like those. I used to recite when I used to do pujas, I used to recite the passages praising the beauty of the Buddha. And there are also these puzzling passages about various Indian gods, which I didn't, you know, couldn't make head nor tail of. It just seemed very weird to me, very interesting but weird. I was ordained in 1976, and by that time I'd moved to our then North London centre in Archway, in North London. And every Friday night, all order members in the area would gather for the weekly order meeting. That's what we called it in those days. And the order meeting began with puja and meditation, and then we'd get together for conversation, reporting in. And the puja was, the meditation we would do would be the visualization practice we were initiated into at the time of our ordination. So we were all doing our special order meditations. And in the puja, there was an extra bit that Sangharakshita had recommended that we recite. And it was a part of the Sutra of Golden Light, part of the confession section that begins with the phrase, "May the Buddhas watch over me with minds attentive, may they forgive my faults, with minds given over to compassion." Very rich, stirring words, including the wonderful line, "And may the Buddhas bathe me in the surging waters of compassion." And Bhante had selected this particular part of the from the Sutra of Golden Light because there's reference to faults committed against the ten precepts, that we take at the time of ordination, and vowing to take up the 10 good acts, in other words, the positive aspect of those precepts, and dwell in the 10th stage, which means the 10th bhumi, enlightenment itself. So the Sutra of Golden Light was around somewhat in the early days of the FWBO. Partly, this was because it was one of the few Mahayana sutras that was reasonably readily available. But I think there must have been a bit more to it than that, because in 1978, Sangharakshita gave a series of 8 lectures at Hampstead Town Hall called Transformation of Life and World in the Sutra of Golden Light. And, all the order members, mitras and friends would, go up to Hampstead, and many other people too. They were open to the public, and there we would sit in the Hampstead Town Hall hearing Sangharakshita lecture on this mysterious sutra. And it was a truly electrifying lecture series. It did something. It had a very powerful effect, I think, on the movement. And it was part of something. It was part of something that was happening. It was as if something was unfolding already. And Sangharakshita, in a way, was giving it a direction, or, if you like, giving it, or placing that in the context of this profound Buddha region, this profound Buddha field called the Sutra of Golden Light. By that time, there was a building team converting the old fire station in Roman Road into the London Buddhist Centre. Padmaloka Retreat Centre had been established for a couple of years. Other centres were starting and developing. There were a lot of communities at this time, people living together, Buddhists living together, and there was the beginnings of team-based, cooperative, right livelihood businesses. And Sangharakshita's lecture series was part of all this. And his lecture series was a radical, unambiguous statement that the Dharma, the Buddha's teaching, Buddhist practice, isn't about a little bit of tampering with our consciousness to make us feel better. The Dharma, the Buddha's teaching, is about nothing less than total transformation. Total transformation, transfiguration of ourselves, of our individual life, and total transformation of the world. Total. To create even a Buddhist culture, a Buddhist world. In that lecture series, he made it clear that Buddhism has an impact, will have an impact. Our practice should be having an impact on all aspects of society, on all aspects of collective life. And the Sutra of Golden Light was the profound Buddha region in which that happens, or describes that process mythically. And I remember vividly Sangharakshita's evocation of that profound Buddha region, that evocation especially of the golden light itself, the golden light of the Dharma, the golden light of reality. And you, when he talked about it, something deeply mysterious was evoked, profound. Something deeply profound was evoked, of immense energy and power. And it became clear that the sutra is not in fact a text at all. The text is just the code, if you like. It's just a code, a key. And if you read it properly, if you really enter into it, it leads into this profound Buddha region of the transforming golden light. Very important to see it. The Sutra of Golden Light is not this. It's not this book. It's not even the different traditional manuscripts of the book. This is a key, a code, an entranceway. So the lecture series had all kinds of effects, actually, which are still unfolding. Very interesting. I'm very glad that Danya suggested that we did this weekend on the Sutra of Golden Light, because it's reminded me of what it was like when Sangharakshita first talked about this sutra and what was going on in the FWBO at that time. And it's very important to revisit that, revisit the energy, if you like, of those times, which, yes, are still unfolding. One particular effect had a particular effect on one order member I can think of immediately, and his name is Lokamitra. The lecture series and the Sutra of Golden Light really affected him very strongly, and it led to him, he said this himself, it was one of the very strong conditions that led him to starting our work in India. Lokamitra really is the founder of our work in India, and I had the great good fortune to go with him when he started our activities in India. I went with him in 78, not long after this lecture series. So this is Sangharakshita Lokamitra working with the followers of Dr. Ambedkar, people who became Buddhist from the really lowest parts of Indian society. And yes, Lokamitra cites the Sutra of Golden Light series as a starting point, perhaps especially the emphasis in that series, not only on transformation of self, but transformation of world. That's the great message. The Dharma must be lived, must shine in all areas of life, economic, cultural. It must shine on the natural world, even on the social and political order. So in this talk, I want to look a little at these topics of transformation of life, of self, and transformation of world, drawing on the Sutra of Golden Light. And actually, I'm going to dwell mostly on the transformation of self. We heard yesterday in Vedanya's masterful talk, all about Ruchira Ketu's meditation on the Buddha, his problem with the length of life of the Buddha, and his great vision of the five Tathagatas, the five Buddhas. And we heard how that vision led to an extraordinary dream, in which in the midst of Buddhas, innumerable Buddhas, I saw Buddhas everywhere, the text says. Ruchira Ketu sees a holy man banging on a great golden drum, from which light and sound in the form of verses continuously stream forth. Verses of praise, of love and dedication, and verses of confession. Many, many verses of confession. And you'll be somewhat familiar with these now because we chanted those verses last night. So I want especially to speak of transformation of self, of individual life, in terms of confession. As Vedanya mentioned yesterday, this notion of confession might not sound very appealing. I don't know what it was like for you during the puja last night, but it's not very appealing, the idea of confession to people. Perhaps our association with the word confession, the word confession just evokes feelings of oppression, guilt, and of making atonement. Maybe it evokes feelings of feeling bad, perhaps even a feeling of being controlled by some external authority. Some people have had a religious conditioning which makes them associate confession with those kinds of feeling. A feeling, if you like, of being somehow bad, with some sort of sin you've been saddled with, but you're not quite sure what it is. And it might come as a real surprise to hear that there is confession in Buddhism. How is that possible? There's no God in Buddhism, no creator God, no deity in Buddhism. Okay, we confessed in front of the Buddhas last night, but there's no implication that the Buddha has created us, or the Buddha's going to sort of have anything to do with punishment and retribution. We confess to the Buddha because he is our teacher. He is the embodiment of the spiritual ideal. So how is it possible that there can be confession in Buddhism? Is it some sort of terrible sort of degeneration from good old rationalistic Shakyamuni Buddha, which is, being facetious, because the Buddha isn't a rationalist, although he's not irrational. Actually, confession as a spiritual practice is found throughout the entire Buddhist world, and it was there from the very earliest days. In the very early days, when the Sangha would meet, the monastic Sangha, and even with the Buddha present, there would be a period where people could confess their faults, their breaches of the precepts. And it was only when that happened that they'd go on with their chanting and recollection of particular teachings of the Buddha. But I can give other examples. For example, the great Chinese teacher Zhe, in his famous text, Dhyana for Beginners, says, before you can effectively meditate, deeply meditate, you need to purify yourself of shame before you meditate. You need to confess. You need to purify yourself of any feelings of guilt and shame. You need to unburden yourself, because that will block you in meditation. You'll have a lot of self-doubt, even self-loathing, and that's going to make it very difficult to make progress in meditation. Sometimes people wonder why they don't progress in meditation. Well, it can be because there's baggage. It's not the only reason, but there's baggage. There's stuff that's unresolved to do with unskillful activity, and it needs to be resolved. If you like, conscience. Our conscience is having a kind of effect on us, so it's making meditation quite difficult. So Jyoti recommends lots of chanting, burning of incense, and so on as a way to purify. Now, in order to understand the meaning of confession in Buddhism, I'm going to use a traditional teaching. This is the teaching known as the Four Powers. The Four Powers that make confession effective. And there's different lists and names for these Four Powers, but this is the one I'm going to use. First of all, there's the power of the object. Secondly, there's the power of shame. Thirdly, there's the power of aspiration. And fourthly, there's the power of applying the antidote. So first of all, there's the power of the object. Actually, it sounds a bit cold, doesn't it? It's not the best way of putting it, actually. Better to say the power of having a spiritual ideal. Or if you like, the power of the golden light of reality, the power of the Buddha. The Sutra of Golden Light, the confessional verses, arise from Ruchiriketu's vision of the Buddhas. His overwhelming vision of the Buddhas. His overwhelming experience of the presence of wisdom and compassion, which he is aspiring to realise in his life, which he's committed to realising in his life. And of course, that vision didn't come by itself. That vision erupted out of the intensity of his spiritual practice, of his spiritual commitment, his going for refuge, as we say, to the spiritual life. So confession in Buddhism is not the expression of a miserable sinner. It's not the expression of some sort of self-abasement. That's not the mood. Confession, real confession, arises from intense love for our spiritual ideals and from the intensity of our commitment to those spiritual ideals, our going for refuge to those ideals. Confession arises out of the intensity of our spiritual practice. Confession arises from our spiritual strength. You could say, even say that confession arises out of inspiration. We feel deeply moved by our spiritual ideals, by their beauty, their searing beauty, their sublimity. And they make us aware, our movement towards them, makes us aware of the meanness, the pettiness, the selfishness, the ugliness of our soul, to use a rather non-Buddhist word. I put that in single inverted commas. Yes, that movement towards the searing beauty of wisdom and compassion just makes us aware of the meanness, pettiness, selfishness and ugliness of our soul. We see all that clearly and we want to rid ourselves of that behaviour and those habits. And that experience can only come when we make a real commitment to spiritual practice and are making an intensive spiritual effort. And the sutra is full of verses. We had them last night. Beautiful verses extolling the Buddha's beauty. You know, all those emphasis on the golden colour of the Buddha. You know, his limbs shining as gold. His fine eyes like blue lotuses. And so on and so forth. It's very much the lush Indian poetic tradition. You know, they say that his hair is black as bees. And things like that. And his fingernails are copper-coloured, all this sort of thing. It's very Indian. Perhaps we'd have a different aesthetic. But it's that beauty that's being evoked. Beauty is so very important in our lives, in our spiritual lives. We need to see the beauty, contemplate the beauty of enlightenment. Goodness has an aesthetic quality to it. When somebody does something, you know, really good, heroically good, when they're deeply ethical, when they act selflessly, when you see somebody acting with true altruism, we don't say, what a good moral person. We say, that's beautiful. That's beautiful. That action is beautiful. You know, if we see a wonderful film or play where there's real, you know, moral courage being used, where somebody really acts with selflessness, we're moved aesthetically by that. There's a rightness about it. So, yes, we need to see the beauty of the spiritual ideal. So first, then, there's the power of the object. And, of course, it's not just something external. As Vedanya was at pains to point out yesterday, we have a response to that spiritual ideal, that spiritual beauty embodied in this case, in the Buddha, in the golden light. And that something in us is Shraddha. It's only because of that Shraddha that we can really see and respond and move towards the Buddha. There's that wonderful saying of Plotinus, the eye can only see the sun because there's something of the sun in the eye. So this is what Shraddha is like. It's that something of the Buddha in us that is seeing and responding to the beauty and the moral and spiritual qualities of the Buddha. So confession is about liberating that piece of the sun, that Shraddha within us, so it's going to shine forth in all its glory. So that's the power of the object. And this brings us to the second power, the power of shame. The power of shame. So, yes, this is the second power. Shame is that feeling of real regret, deep regret for the unskillfulness that we've done. Real shame, burning shame at going against our spiritual ideals. And of course, this is a very strong feature of that Sutra of Golden Light. You know, those verses full of shame and regret and remorse and an awareness. When it talks about fear here, it's really talking about, it's not the sort of fear and dread you experience with guilt, it's more a sense of the consequences of actions. And it's very important to understand that shame is not the same as guilt. Guilt is a very different thing. And I think we should try and distinguish shame and guilt. I mean, this could take a whole lecture in itself, so I'm going to be simplistic. Guilt is really something irrational. It's that feeling of dread that something terrible will happen to you. So there's going to be some terrible rejection that's going to happen to you, or catastrophe, because you are a bad and evil person. If we were to analyse this, you know, if we were to look for why we feel this, we might not find that we've done anything unskillful. In fact, if we look, we won't see any behaviour that's unskillful that makes us have those feelings of dread. We just feel bad, and we want to find some way of feeling good again. And the way we try to do that is by pleasing others in some way. This is all very complicated, and it's a lot to do with early conditioning and all that sort of thing. And it's tied up with things like authority projections and all that kind of thing. Guilt actually governs a lot of human relationships. People will do anything sometimes not to be rejected, not to be disliked, not to be spurned by the group, by loved ones. They'll even do unskillful things to be liked by other people. I've known people who felt guilty about being generous, about being truthful, about being happy at, you know, being a good person, because they're frightened of the response from certain other people, from the group. What the Sutra of Golden Light calls evil friends. That's what the group is. They want to keep us where we are. They want to keep us stuck. They want to perpetuate our unskillful activity. And if we stand as an individual, if we break away and start behaving skillfully, they can reject us. That can be very frightening, and a lot of guilt can come up in relation to that. Sangharakshita says, true Buddhist confession you can't do it if you're in a state of guilt. It is really interesting. But if there's guilt in the way I'm talking about it, you can't really confess, because it means you're still part of a sort of group mentality, if you like. Shame is very, very different. Shame arises out of a clear sense of going against our spiritual ideals. We see clearly that certain things we do go against our ideals, and we feel a healthy regret and shame for that. No one is punishing us. No one will reject us. It's not like that at all. It's us seeing clearly. We've internalized, if you like, our sense of the Buddha. Our spiritual ideals are inside us. They're guiding us much more. And we feel ashamed. We feel we've let ourselves down when we go against those ideals, when we behave unskillfully. Shame itself is actually regarded in Buddhist tradition as one of the central skillful states of mind. It's one of the most positive and creative states of mind. And it's painful when it arises, but it's actually skillful and creative and positive. This is really interesting. You know, a skillful state isn't always a happy state. You see clearly that your actions have gone against your own ideals and principles, and that burns you. That burns you. It's, if you like, our ideals. If you like, the Buddha within, if you want to use that sort of language, is rising up in relation to our behaviour. And it's rising up in a sense of burning us. The golden light is burning us. The word for shame in Sanskrit is hri, which comes from a root meaning to blush, which is very interesting. And it's also the seed syllable of the Buddha Amitabha. We chant the mantra Om Amideva Hri. It's the same word. So the word for shame and the seed syllable of the red Buddha Amitabha over there, on the wall over there. When we feel shame, it's, if you like, Amitabha, the Buddha of infinite light that is rising up within us. We're blushing, we're going his colour. Buddhahood is rising up and bringing us back to what is important, to the truly real. So Hri, you can also say, is a very healthy self-respect, except the self here is not your sort of egotism. Yourself here is your identification with your spiritual ideal, with wisdom and compassion. You could even call it, the tantric tradition talks about Buddha pride. And as Sangharakshita's Chinese teacher, Mr. Chen, used today, he said, well, supposing you're meditating on Avalokiteshvara, you're identifying with the Lord of Great Compassion, and you're about to do something really mean and selfish, you think, oh, I'm Avalokiteshvara. Avalokiteshvara doesn't do this. I feel the pride of Avalokiteshvara. It's the way he used to explain things. So shame is a bit like that. But it's felt as a sort of burning. But there's real clarity. You know what you've done. You can identify it. You see it. And it burns you. Unlike guilt, which, you know, when you're in that guilty state, and you meet people in a guilty state, they're just confused. They're in this fog of confusion and dread and fear. Very, very different from the clarity of shame. The word for confession in Sanskrit is papa deshana. I'll say something about the word papa in a minute. Deshana literally means a pointing out, a clear pointing out to ourselves of all those actions that go against our spiritual ideals. So yes, it brings out this translation, deshana, as pointing out, points out, brings out the clarity aspect of confession. Papa can only really be translated as evil. And some of you may have really balked at this word last night in the puja. All the evil I have done, over and over again. And I know that some people say, well look, I'm not evil. Why not have a nice lighter word like faults or something like that? Or I don't know, even something lighter than that. And actually, I know some Western Buddhists, actually not that many, who really don't like this word evil, and they want it banned from our pujas. But papa is a very strong word in Sanskrit. And evil is the only possible translation. Papa, evil, connotes bad action, unskillful action, and all the trouble and misfortune that comes from that bad, that unskillful action. And of course, we all think, well, I'm not like that. I'm not an evil person. I've got a few faults, but basically I'm a nice, good person. So, you know, my confession can be quite low-key. I'll just confess my faults. Let's not bother with this word evil. And maybe that's so, but I'll speak personally. I have no doubt at all that there are tendencies in me which could do real harm to myself and others. They don't, which I would describe, they have the potential for evil. They don't do that because of two things, because of my spiritual practice and because of good conditions. And I don't just mean good Buddhist conditions like living here and being surrounded by spiritual friends. But I also include being in a reasonably stable society. But I do wonder, sometimes in the middle of the night, oh, I wonder how it would be, how I would be, if there was major social and civil disruption, or if I was under attack and I was under threat, what might be unleashed in me? I was very, very struck during the Balkan Wars, you know, the wars in Serbia, Bosnia, those sorts of things, hearing neighbours, people who were neighbourly to one another, expressing terrible hatred of one another, wanting each other's deaths. You know, these people who lived together, apparently okay, suddenly when the conditions change, they're the deadliest enemies. Seen it in India. Muslims and Hindus living quite happily. When riots happen, neighbours turn on each other. These are good, ordinary people. Hannah Arendt's banality of evil comes to mind. And this could also include not just doing overtly evil action. What about just ignoring, neglecting the good? What about, you know, not standing up in the good when others are under threat? It includes that. You know, very often if we see films where, you know, a kind of group turns, you know, against a minority, of course, we wouldn't do that, would we? We wouldn't be the oppressive majority against the minority. We would be the minority really helping. We would be the rebels. Is that true? Can we really be sure of that? I think we can be very, very complacent about our capacity for goodness. And if we've ever had the misfortune to sell out, to sell our principles, even on a small level, maybe at work, maybe in college, that gives us an indication of how we would be. How independent is our goodness? Would we, could we stand alone in the good? Could we stand alone in the good? Great evil can be perpetrated because we cannot stand alone in the good. So we need to confess our evil. And by evil, the Sutra of Golden Light means the unskillfulness that is deeply rooted in consciousness, deeply rooted in unconsciousness, if you like. And that confession means confessing everything. And I mean everything. It means confessing the effects and the roots of all unskillful actions done in ignorance over lifetimes. This is the Buddhist perspective. That's why we're here, according to Buddhist tradition, because of lifetimes of ignorance. This is what the confession verses in the Sutra of Golden Light are evoking. It's a liturgy that is about, that is designed, if you like, designed because it comes out of tremendous inspiration. It's a liturgy that churns the depths of our conditioned samsaric being. That's what's going on. It's the churning the depths of samsara. The verses represent the golden light of reality shining into the darkest, the chthonic, atavistic, nescient areas of being. Sangharakshita even says the golden light is a spiritual emetic, and it will cause us to actually vomit up absolutely everything. It will vomit up ourselves in all our awfulness. And this golden light is a light that causes us to be completely, devastatingly truthful. Absolutely truthful. We'll be absolutely truthful with ourselves. And it's about taking complete responsibility for ourselves. I realised last night when we were doing the puja, especially the confession section, one of the reasons why the Sutra of Golden Light is regarded itself as powerful, its recitation, is because Buddhism operates in a culture where the asseveration of truth is regarded as having power. You know, if you can say, this is true, this is this, that will have magical effects on reality. So the more you can recite those verses with real conviction and depth, and the more you live the words you're saying, the more power they have on you and your environment. And yes, there's this great emphasis on individual responsibility. We confess everything. We confess all our actions of greed, hatred, delusion, jealousy, lust, and so on and so forth. Whatever the conditions, whatever's kind of brought them about, whatever evil action we've done under the influence of bad friends, we can no longer say, well, it wasn't my fault. There were all these other people. But you did the deed. You did the deed. You did it. Okay, there were these conditions. Understood. But you did it. I did it. And then there's that wonderful section of confessions. Real insight here. The faults you've done because of the oppressions. We get oppressed. We get squeezed by life. Life is full of the most terrible pressures, internal pressures, our particular conditioning, our temperament, external pressures from, you know, work, family, changes in the weather, you know, whatever it might be, the government, so many bad conditions that kind of squeeze us and confine us and seem to be impelling us towards unskillful action. The sutra understands that, the Buddha understands that. But if we behaved unskillfully, if we have harmed someone, it's our fault. It's our evil. It's our unskillfulness. Ignorance is even confessed. I didn't know. Well, of course we don't know. That's the tragedy of life. That's the tragedy of samsaric life. But a Buddhist takes responsibility for their unknowing and the effects of their unknowing, and learns to see clearly, and learns to put the effects of unknowing right. So the confession verses of the Sutra of Golden Light is not simply a liturgy. We're not just talking about Buddhist ceremonial here. These confession verses are actually the expression of wisdom, of insight into the reality of things. They are the expression of an overwhelming encounter with transcendental reality, with the force of wisdom and compassion, undiluted wisdom and compassion. We go for wisdom and liberation and insight and all the rest of it, but, you know, be clear of the consequences. There's going to be this massive vomiting up of the roots of all evil. And, you know, frankly, if that's not going on, I really do wonder about the quality of the wisdom. So let's go to thirdly, the power of aspiration. Well, the effect of confession is actually a wonderful feeling of lightness, if you really do it. There's a sense of the dropping of all burdens. The first really intensive experience of confession happened to me in 1990. I mean, I had practiced confession before, more, as it were, spontaneously, you know, when there were obvious things to confess. But on the Gukhiloka ordination course in 1990, for the first time on that course, we had a period of purification before the ordinations. This is part of a 4-month ordination course. And we had confession groups. We set up groups where every day we would systematically go through the precepts that we were going to, the people were going to take at ordination, the 10 precepts, and confessed our faults. Just talked about things that we'd done that we regretted, to clear the decks. And it was happening in the context of doing a confession puja, the Sutra of Golden Light puja every evening. Lots of chanting of the mantra of Vajrasattva. That's Vajrasattva, who is the Buddha of primordial purity. And now it's a standard part of the course, this period of confession and purification. And there was a wonderful mood that developed. I remember it very well. First of all, it was very sober, really deep. The whole thing seemed to just really deepen. A great sense of sobriety and seriousness. Some people were saying things that they'd never said before to anybody, even the people they were closest to. Now they felt they could. They had the context, which wasn't a psychotherapeutic context, but a spiritual, even a transcendental context, in which their spiritual ideals were vividly before them. They were committing to them. They wanted to clear the decks. And then, after that, there was just this wonderful feeling of lightening and freeing. I remember noticing particularly some people's faces changing as we went through this period. They'd soften and relax. They'd start to glow. People's eyes got a lot softer. There was a sense of people being kind of renewed, even reborn. And a real sense of sort of closeness to one another, a real intimacy with one another, a spiritual intimacy. And, the confession just led to silence. It was people sitting with one another in complete silence, in complete harmony. So this is what can happen. So naturally, out of this, you make aspirations. That wonderful section that we had last night in the puja, the section of well-wishing. Beautiful section where we wish for the very best for ourselves and all beings. We also commit ourselves, we recommit ourselves to the attainment of enlightenment for all beings. And, in confession, if we're actually doing it with other people, we'll be specific as well about the positive, skillful actions that we want to do, that we will put in place. We might even take vows to do particular things, particular practices to support our skillful action. So that's the power of aspiration. And fourthly, there's the power of applying the antidote. So for effective confession, we need to change our actions and behaviour. We need to do something. We need to act differently. Not just to not do those particular unskillful things that we've confessed, but to do skillful things, to actually do them. In the end, the aim of confession is to act in full accordance with our spiritual ideals, in full accordance with the golden light. That's what we're aiming for. Of course, this is a long process, and our confession practice will be on levels of greater and greater subtlety. You often find in the Buddhist text this little phrase, seeing danger in trifling faults, seeing danger in the little things, in the little habits. They're indicators of something much, much deeper. The Buddha and the great teachers often talk about this. Pay attention to the little things. We will also be doing greater good, and not just for ourselves, but for the world as well. And this brings us to the second part of this talk, a much shorter part of the talk, transformation of world. So in Vidanya's talk and in the puja, it was incredibly vivid in the puja last night, after the great confession and well-wishing, there is the eruption of all these different gods and spirits who vow, who promise to protect and support the teacher of the sutra and those who recite the sutra. I found it really quite thrilling, that especially the last section where the Buddhas appear and calling us good fellows for reciting the sutra. I really loved that. So Vidanya told us how the universe responds when we fully open up to the golden light of reality. We can also see these gods and beings as representing different aspects of life that need to be transformed by the Dharma, by the golden light of the Dharma. Now, this is a huge topic, and I can only say, a very little here. It will be sketchy, and, in a way, I just jotted down the first things that came to me, so I haven't sort of thought things through a great deal here, but I did want to say something. I really recommend that you read Sangharakshita's book, Transforming Self and World, or better still, listen to the original lectures. Listen to the original lectures. I mean, some people find Sangharakshita's lecture style, rather old-fashioned. But honestly, it well worth listening, to those lectures. And the main point here, as I said at the beginning of this talk, practicing the Dharma is not about a bit of tampering with ourselves to make us feel more comfortable, just to make samsara a bit more comfortable. The aim is, and this is completely explicit in the WBO and the FWBO, that the aim is total transformation of self and world. You know, I remember, you know, that was, used to happen in India. Somebody would come up to me and say, "Oh, I'm interested in meditation, but I don't want it to, I don't want to have too much of an effect. You know, I just want," and I used to say, "I don't think I should teach it to you. I think you'll be disappointed. I think it might start making demands on you that you might, and I, you know, I don't want to sort of mislead you." Maybe that was a lack of skillful means on my part, I don't know. But anyway, let's look at some of these characters. So first of all, the four great kings. So Vedanya's talked about these different characters. I'm just going to pick out something, what the implications for us as practitioners. The four great kings. Well, we've got to have something of the four great kings in us. We need to see the Sangha, the spiritual community, as having an aspect of being the protectors of the spiritual world, the transcendental world. That's where the four kings are situated. They're kind of situated at the interface between, if you like, the ordinary world and the spiritual world. So we need to reflect on this, that when we're involved in a spiritual community, we have a tremendous responsibility to keep alive spiritual values, to keep alive the integrity of the spiritual community, which of course means keeping alive our own integrity. Yes, we don't often sort of think like that, that the importance of protection, but spiritual life needs to be protected. And even some people who are apparently interested in spiritual life aren't. They aren't. They sound as though they are, but they have all sorts of views and attitudes which are actually going to undermine the spiritual life. And they need to change. They need to change. So we need to see ourselves as protectors. Then there's Saraswati, the goddess of learning and culture. The golden light of the Dharma needs to transform the world of the arts, learning and culture generally. This is a huge topic, and it usually kind of gets people going a bit when you talk about art and culture. Sangharakshita said once he was in New Zealand, and he said it was really interesting. He said nobody sort of really argued very much with him when he was talking about the Dharma, but as soon as he said something about art, everybody was getting stuck in and disagreeing with him. And he thought that was quite interesting. He said, well, you know, I didn't really know much about Buddhism, but they thought they knew something about art. Of course, so much of our culture is so utterly banal. It doesn't bear any higher values at all. It's actually anti-culture in the sense of sort of destroying that which will draw us together. So much of what passes for culture is a celebration of mediocrity and ugliness. So Buddhists need to be developing a much more refined, truly educated sensibility. They need to develop a real aesthetic sense, and I don't mean that in a kind of lovey way. To have a real sense of the real meaning of beauty and truth and how that is best expressed. So real appreciation and even practice of the arts needs to be informed by the Sutra of Golden Light, by the Golden Light of the Dharma. In fact, this room is very, very interesting, you know, with these paintings. You know, these paintings are done by an older member named Arloka. And Arloka, you know, is completely trained in the Western tradition of painting. These are, if you like, records of his grappling with Eastern iconographies. A Western Buddhist who was trained as an artist grappling with Eastern Buddhist iconography. And interestingly enough, I know Arloka, the artist who painted these paintings, was incredibly inspired by the Sutra of Golden Light lecture series. And you know, also, I should just say, one of the interesting things about him, he doesn't regard himself as an artist. He regards himself as a Buddhist who goes for refuge, who happens to paint pictures. In other words, his painting, not just his iconography, but his own personal explorations of art, are all the expressions of Buddhist practice. It's that way round. He sees himself as a servant of the spiritual community. Very, very interesting. Then there arises Shri, the goddess of wealth. So the goddess of wealth represents the transformation of economic life. Very topical, given the state of things. Economics are incredibly powerful. Money is incredibly powerful, makes the world go round. And Shri is a very powerful goddess. Mammon is a very powerful god. So the golden light really needs to shine there. When Sangharakshita first came back to the West, he was driven through the city of London, and he said to the person he was with, "This is what we are up against. This is what we're up against." So the golden light needs to shine on economics. What I'm going to say is going to sound very simplistic to you. I hope there's no economists here. Sangharakshita, in his lecture on Buddhist economics, he doesn't try to kind of give some theory of Buddhist economics. He just makes the point that Buddhist economics are an economics of giving. Buddhist economics is an economics of giving, as opposed to an economics of taking, as opposed to an economics of greed. We've got that word that really infuriates me when I hear it. Well, infuriates me in a mild way, because, you know, I do the Metta Bath now. I can't stand it when politicians or, you know, people who run health authorities talk about the consumer. I'm a consumer. You know, just like it's almost all these consumers, all these sort of black holes in which things are sort of, you know, funneled into. I'm not a human being. You know, I'm not a human being brimming with spiritual potential and all the rest of it. I'm a consumer who consumes. What a giveaway. What an indictment of our world that people can talk like that, can be allowed to talk like that, that they can just slip into, you know, common discourse. Consumers. It's disgusting. You know, it's such a disgusting way of describing us. So if we're going to practice, instead of being a consumer, if we're going to practice the economics of giving, the economics of generosity, we're going to have to engage in a radical simplification of lifestyle. We need a much simpler life. And that's fine, because we're rich, we're wealthy with the golden light. And because we practice generosity, there's much greater solidarity and cooperation, much more of a sense of friendship, much more of a sense of resources being held in common. This is the sort of thing that we have to move towards. And of course, we need to challenge the, you know, the inequality of wealth and things like that. You know, and in terms of practice, our attempts at, you know, very, very, you know, early attempts at team-based right livelihood and living communally are steps in these directions. They're not the only ways, but believe me, if we're going to really shine the light of the Dharma into the area of economics, we have to simplify our lives. And of course, simplifying our lives could have a very powerful effect on our environment. And then there arises the earth goddess, Drudha. So this is the effect of the Dharma on the earth. Those beautiful verses, you know, about, really lovely, wasn't it? Sort of vision of a kind of, you know, wonderful, you know, an earth renewed. And of course, this is very, very topical. So much to do with environmentalism. We're reminded of it all the time. It's a huge topic, and there's a real need for a truly Buddhist perspective and response to these issues of pollution of the environment, climate change, and so on and so forth. Frankly, I don't see it yet. I don't see it yet. I don't see a really genuine, good, clear Buddhist response to it. Some Buddhists themselves have just got caught up in the general horrified anxiety and the doomsaying and the apocalyptic prophecy and the dogmatism that seems to surround, you know, the very complex issues to do with this particular area. It's not Buddhist at all, actually, some of the responses I've even heard from Buddhists to this particular area. What we need, first of all, is action. And that means having, again, a much simpler life. If we really want to make a difference to our environment, we need you know, to reduce input. We need to live much more simply. We need to move to a much more kind of communal life, a cooperative life. And again, that's possible because we're rich with the golden life. We need to take up the first precept really rigorously, really practice non-harm in relation to our environment. And that means reverence for all life. So it means definitely being vegetarian, even being vegan. But again, not in a sort of dogmatic, aggressive kind of way. It's weird, isn't it? You get sort of militant vegans who think it's okay to beat people up, you know, who eat, you know, cream buns. I mean, it's absolutely absurd. Absolutely absurd. Deeply hypocritical. We need to practice, you know, a deep reverence for life with real humility as well. And we also need to cultivate equanimity. Equanimity and clarity. Life does change. Life is transient. The world actually is never going to last forever. That doesn't mean we should hasten it on, but the world will arise and pass away. It's in the nature of things. Now, this shouldn't lead to a quietism or anything like that. We do what we can through action, not through lecturing, through action. But we're doing it primarily because we see that the earth supports the growth and development of individuals. Frankly, I don't want an earth, you know, if there are McDonald's from Vladivostok to Guadalajara. You know, I don't want that if there's Kentucky Fried Chicken on every street corner, you know, and all we hear about culturally is Katie Price and things like that. I don't want it. I'd rather it did dissolve into the firestorm. Okay, I'm being extreme here. Mr. Microphone and people hearing this on the internet, I know I've just gone over the top. I'm sure there'll be lots of reactions and disagreements with this point. Hands up. But something has to be said. The Sutra of Golden Light also makes reference to the transformation of social, even political life. There's a chapter in the Sutra of Golden Light which Sangharakshita lectures on. It's called the Chapter on Instructions Concerning Divine Kings. Very strange chapter in many ways. And he gave a lecture on this called The Moral Order and Its Upholders. And the basic point here seems to be is that the social order and the political order should reflect the basic Buddhist principle of karma. That our individual actions have consequences. Skillful actions lead to happiness and well-being for self and other. Unskillful actions lead to suffering for self and other. The true king, the true government, inspired by the Dharma, inspired by the golden light, would protect the law of karma and uphold that law of karma and support that law of karma. And society would be arranged according to that natural morality. It would be governed by that natural morality. And the Buddhist tradition would see this, that this law of karma, and also we should add to that what's called the golden rule, treating others as you would treat yourself. That's implicit to the law of karma. So Buddhist tradition would see the law of karma as holding society together. That is the social contract. Dada Rinpoche, Sangharakshita's teacher, his picture there, when he was asked, you know, when he ran a school for Tibetan refugees, when he was asked, do you want your pupils to become Buddhist when they leave school or to keep up their Buddhism, he said, I will be happy if they understand that actions, their actions, have consequences. So in other words, that's he regarded as the basics, the basic, if you like, rule of human life. But the basic point, if you like, here is that Buddhists individually and collectively should be involved in strengthening what makes for a truly human society. Leading a spiritual life. We need to strengthen social links, strengthen what binds human beings together into a harmonious society. It's very, very important. It's what people want and need. They want and need that basic protection. Social and civil breakdown has a terrible effect on leading a truly human life, leaving aside following a spiritual life. And we have to do our work. We have to do our bit wherever we find ourselves. I mean, we do our little bit here in relation to the village. We have a very, very good relationship to the village. You know, and, you know, it must be a bit odd for them sometimes to see all these groups of men in pairs, you know, walking around the village. And people are very, very understanding and generally very appreciative. And they actually asked one of us to be a school governor. Ariapala is one of the school governors with the local school. They wanted us involved. The school children come and visit here, you know, when they do their little Buddhist project every year. We've had the village fete here at Padmaloka every other year, and, you know, some of the funds go to church restoration and things like that. So, neighbourliness. We're not trying to convert people. We just want there to be harmony and cohesion in our village. And it's interesting that I've arrived at this rather humble point. I've arrived at the everyday, at what's on our doorstep. Transformation of life and world begins right here and right now, in our heart and in our world. So what are you going to do to transform yourself and to transform your world? The Sutra of Golden Light, the Dharma, the Buddha, is asking us that question.